This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com. Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com.
Welcome to the briefing room with me, David Aronovich. Let's pretend we're important folk who need to make a decision on a big issue of the day. But first, we need to get briefed by the experts, and there's only 28 minutes to do it in. Step inside, where this week we're asking why the British Armed Forces are struggling to find recruits and what effect that has on Britain's ability to fight wars. And if you enjoy this, you might want to listen back to other editions of The Briefing Room. Just type BBC Briefing Room into your favourite search engine. One of our contributors last week told us with some prescience that he thought Italy might be headed for new elections. This week, we're asking why the British Armed Forces are struggling to find recruits and what effect that has on Britain's ability to fight wars. And if you get a moment, please let us know what you think by writing a review or rating us on iTunes or your podcast provider. My thanks to Clovis Crun and Old Robinho for their recent reviews. Anyway, for now, take your seat in the briefing room.
For your mates, for your family, for each other. To train, to learn, to better yourself, for the travel, for the action, for adventure.
For all the attractions of recruiting ads like that, the military is suffering a recruitment problem. The National Audit Office reported in April that across the three armed services, the number of full-time personnel is almost 6% below what's required. That's more than 8,000 men and women.
With courage, with pride. As a unit, as a team, through it all, together.
So I want to know what's going on. Why are the armed forces struggling to find recruits or to keep the people it's got? And what does all this mean for Britain's ability to be involved in military action? Step into the briefing room to find out. First, I want to know, why do people want to join up? Mike Martin served as a captain in the Royal Yeomanry in Helmand Province during Britain's deployment to Afghanistan, and he's recently published a book called Why We Fight. Here's his take.
I'm of the 9/11 generation. I was 15 when Tony Blair came to power and 18 when the Twin Towers fell. And anyone who joined the army in that period knew that they were going to Iraq or Afghanistan. I think the fact that Iraq and Afghanistan were ongoing was pretty central to my decision to join the army. It's a gross pastiche, but there are basically two types of soldiers. There are peacetime soldiers and there are wartime soldiers. And people of my generation who joined up were very much wartime soldiers. They knew they were going to Iraq and Afghanistan. That was why they joined. I think at its core, for me, was a desire to prove myself, to take part in combat and to see how I behaved or how I fared when I was with other soldiers in this extreme environment. So I was in Afghanistan for about 2 years, of which 6 months were spent on the ground, going from compound to compound and fighting and patrolling. And in that time, I was probably in about 30 or 40 firefights. I remember the first time that I went on patrol and came under fire and return fire. And actually, it was for a lot of the soldiers who were also on that patrol, it was their first firefight. And we sort of left the patrol base and advanced towards where we thought the enemy were going to be, and we came under fire whilst we were in the middle of a field and dashed into a tree line where there was a ditch, and then started returning fire. And looking up and down the ditch, people were shouting and whooping for joy. I mean, this was a moment of great joy for many of the people who were taking part in it. It was utterly exhilarating. I think there's a continuum, actually, between how I thought it would be and how I imagined it would be and how it was, except when I experienced combat, it was 20 times more thrilling and more exciting than I thought it would have been. I did see men wounded and killed, and I always have to caveat when I talk about the positive emotions around combat, of course, that exhilaration turns to fear if something goes wrong and you feel like you're an animal about to be killed. And of course, sadness and anger and lots of other very negative emotions if one of your comrades has his leg blown off or gets killed. I do quite a lot of speaking about conflict and about Afghanistan, and there's something that I've noticed that is shared amongst advanced democratic nations. Fighting is a taboo. And more precisely, the fact that soldiers enjoy fighting and are motivated to fight, and this is particularly young men, although it does happen to young women as well, the fact that they enjoy fighting is a taboo. We don't like to talk about that in our societies, but we should be very careful about mixing what is with what should be. You've got to answer the question why so many soldiers are motivated to fight when historically there's been such a high death rate. And actually, there are two things that they gain through fighting which offset that death rate, and those are increased social status and belonging to a cohesive in-group. And that's what motivates people to fight. So when we look at, for example, the British Army's current advertising campaign, which is obviously trying to deal with this dearth and problems with recruitment that they're facing at the moment, it's called This Is Belonging. And it is about mundane activities and soldiers in the rain, supposedly miserable, but they're not. They're happy because they're there with their mates and they belong to a cohesive clique. So it's those two things, status and belonging, that we've evolved to pursue, and that's what drives us to fight. And I think the Army's been quite clever in using one of those in its advertising campaign.
Mike Martin. So despite the appeal to belonging, why is a career in the armed forces apparently less attractive than it once was? And it's not only a question of recruitment, it's also one of retention. Anthony King is chair in war studies at Warwick University. In Afghanistan, he served as a civilian advisor to the then British commander, General Sir Nick Carter, who is today head of the army. Now, explicit in what Mike was saying was the sense that if you don't have a conflict to go to, you might not be quite so interested for various reasons in joining up.
I completely agree with Mike Martin there, and indeed, empirically, there is evidence for it. So if you look at the recruitment figures for the army, the recruitment figures in a way, paradoxically, for a civilian observing it, the recruitment figures improve very significantly during the period 2003 to 2012. So precisely the period when the British Army in particular is committed to Basra and committed to Helmand and Afghanistan. So there is actually structural evidence that young men and young women are attracted by the allure of proving themselves, the excitement of real high-intensity operations.
Now, let's talk a bit about the who of this. I don't imagine that the army or the armed forces generally recruit evenly from across all sections of society. In other words, there have been some sections of society that they've more traditionally recruited from than others.
Absolutely. And if we were to put this in a historical framework, there is a very striking structure to the recruitment pattern. So if you go back to 1990, the end of the Cold War, essentially the army was 150,000 strong. It was made up almost exclusively of white working class men from the inner city. That constituency is still extremely important to the army. The army still is about 85%, 82, 85% white working class individuals. But of course, the army has expanded and expanded in a number of quite interesting ways. So women now form a very significant part of the army, about 9%, and have featured in combat. You know, they've played a very important role in both Helmand and Iraq and in the current force. And of course, there has been an increase to about 10% in the army of ethnic minorities. Now, it's worth making one point about the ethnic minorities. Some of them absolutely are British passport-holding citizens from inner-city areas or from other areas in Britain, just like their white compatriots. But what's been very significant since the end of the Cold War, and especially the last 15 years, is the uptake of so-called Commonwealth troops. So troops from especially Grenada and Fiji as ethnic minorities, but also from South Africa. And so some of those ethnic minority figures actually are Commonwealth soldiers. So the British Army is a more multicultural force than it has been.
You've explained this partially, or we've explained it partially so far, by the absence of an animating conflict. But there's also, hasn't there been, a kind of slightly off-putting aspect to the way in which that conflict has been more widely understood in British society, don't you think?
Yeah, I completely agree. Undoubtedly, there is a Helmand factor that has now gone away. But interestingly, one of the really striking features of those campaigns in Iraq, and then especially in Afghanistan in Helmand, was the way that soldiers who were killed in Helmand were subsequently commemorated. And the MOD and the government and media essentially colluded in this representation. The representation effectively resulted in soldiers being seen by the British public not as service personnel who were highly professional, who'd taken their risks and unfortunately had fallen in the service of the country, but they were actually victims of a tragic and forlorn and futile situation. And that, I think, has been very dangerous and potentially very damaging for the armed forces and the army in particular. And one looks at a post-Helmand, post-Iraq army in which the allure of combat is no longer there for young people. And for parents and families, they see the armed forces, although they nominally have pride in the British Armed Forces, they no longer understand or empathise with them, but actually just sympathise with soldiers. And I think British public culture has ended up in a quite poignant and difficult place for the armed forces at this point.
I remember when the Army Recruitment Office, or the Forces Recruitment Office, was a kind of fairly major staple in quite a lot of high streets and so on. There were visits to schools and so on, and there were cadet forces and things like that. Have these diminished, or do they still do all these things?
I mean, the Army still run recruiting services within most significant towns, and those outreach programmes still exist. But of course, there's been a couple of things that are very important here. I mean, the infamous employment, the contract to Capita, is widely seen in the MOD and the armed forces as a mistake.
Tell us about that.
So Capita signed a contract, £1 billion contract, to provide the recruiting services, both physically identifying individuals who might be future soldiers and future members of the armed services, and then provided the actual administrative structure, the software for those recruits to provide their information so that their applications could be processed. And certainly the MOD and the armed forces think that some of the downturn in recruitment is based on the difficulties that Capita have introduced into the system. Certainly, February 2018, the figure was it took 300 days for an application to the armed forces to be processed electronically by Capita. Well, self-evidently, 300 days for an 18-year-old is a rather long amount of their life.
It's rather a long time for a 63-year-old, frankly.
Absolutely. I'd say something more than this. That the employment of Capita points to precisely the point you make, which is, as a result, very substantially, of the mere contraction of the size of the army and the armed forces, that the organic connection between the armed forces and the army and British civil society has actually become attenuated, that people don't know soldiers, and that I think that has materially affected the profile and the attractiveness of the armed forces.
Let's talk about retention. Why is there such a difficulty in retaining people?
There are a number of reasons. At the very highest level, the very size and the low manning of the armed forces is a problem. What happens in the armed forces? Their operational commitments, because of defence policy, remain utterly the same. So if you've got 5% less soldiers in the army, as they have, and in fact, from 10 years ago, you have 25,000 less soldiers, they're still committed to the same number of operations, to the same number of training missions, exercises, etc. And so the pressure on the remaining constituency, the remaining soldiers and service personnel, has increased. There are other factors as well. 25, 30 years ago, the armed forces was predominantly all male. There were about 5% women, but it was predominantly all male. And the essential contract was this. One married, one's wife gave up her job, and you became an army family. That no longer pertains. Both spouses are employed. The double employment of both spouses put huge domestic pressure on the retention of service. And there are real stress points in the skilled areas. So in the skilled areas of senior NCOs, senior non-commissioned officers, and middle-ranking officers, captains and majors, are absolutely critical to the functioning of these forces. The civilian world offers, for their skill set, very attractive employment, which alleviates many of those domestic problems. So there's a multiple series of issues that are pressurising the armed force retention.
Anthony King, and I'll be talking to him again later about what could be done to reverse this situation. So, next question. How does a shortfall in numbers affect the ability of the British armed forces to operate effectively? I'm joined in the briefing room by Ben Barry, a British infantry officer for 20 years and currently a senior fellow at the International Institute for Strategic Studies in London, and on the line from Southampton, Mandy Hickson, who's a former RAF pilot. Mandy Hickson, you actually flew fighter jets to enforce the no-fly zone in Iraq. Now, that presumably took a substantial operation. Could you do the same thing now on the resources currently available?
I think it's challenging. I mean, when I look at how the numbers have changed since when I joined. So I joined in 94 and there was about 80,000 people in the Air Force. When I left, there was 45,000. So I'd seen a massive reduction in the 17 years that I served. And now we're down to, 32,800, I believe. And we very much talk about this agile and fighting force, you know, this future force for 2020. And it's all about sort of the lean process, working more smartly. But you can't take away the fact that actually you still need people. And, you know, it's very, very challenging to actually mount exercises and missions in combat zones when you are cutting the corners too much. And I think you need to be very, very careful.
Is your impression that we have reached the position whereby manpower, person power has been reduced too far?
I think there's a lot of frustration. I think it reads across in a very similar vein to the NHS. You know, when you look at our NHS and how tight it is on resources and personnel, I think we're in a similar situation now. And I think there's a very fine line. And actually, for the fine line being, people want to be on detachment. They enjoy a deployment and that operational tempo that comes with it. But if there's too many, then actually people are never at home and it becomes frustrating, especially if you're in a very, very small force, which the Tornado has obviously become as it's winding down to actually, you know, go out of service. And so, you know, it is challenging. And I think the morale ends up getting quite low when people are away for too many months of the year, because, of course, the stress and the strain on family life as well is very challenging. And I noticed from the recent Armed Forces Attitude Survey, 25% of people are wanting to leave as soon as possible. Now, that's quite a shocking statistic. It really is. And I think, though, when people are starting to talk like that, it's about really trying to look ahead. And you know, and I'm sure that's what you'll be hearing from other people today.
Have you ever been able, since you left, to persuade somebody else to go into the armed forces?
Well, actually, that's exactly what I do now, to be honest, David. So I'm a motivational speaker. I go and speak at a lot of schools, a lot of conferences. And the big comment I always get is, how do I sign up?
Ben Barry, if I could turn to you now. Where are British forces in the world at the moment? Where are we deployed?
Well, the biggest operation is the one against Daesh, where there's still a mopping up phase going on with quite considerable numbers of Army and Royal Air Force. There's 600 odd people in Kabul, Afghanistan. There's a British battle group of about 700 in Estonia. And then there's quite a lot of small detachments, a mixture of attaches, advisory missions and training teams, particularly in Africa, in Ukraine and the Middle East.
Now, Daesh, of course, is what we tend to call at the BBC, the so-called Islamic State, just for those listeners who aren't aware of all the different names that they go by. So that's where they are. What do British military planners see today as being the biggest future threat and current threat that we have to deploy against?
Well, I think even after Daesh are largely physically defeated, there will be a threat from violent extremist organisations such as Al-Qaeda, the Taliban. There is, of course, the threat of domestic terrorism. One thing that has changed over the last few years is the 3,000 odd troops from all three services that are on very short notice to reinforce the police. But in terms of big threats, I think on the mind of the Defence Secretary and the service chiefs is Russia. Because since 2014 and Russia's interference in Ukraine, the prism has certainly moved. And both the Defence Secretary, the Army Chief and the other service chiefs have really been saying that now is the principal threat driver as the most challenging opponent for the armed forces.
And the National Audit Office says that we can't recruit up to the levels that we would want at the moment across the three services. Now, does that matter? I mean, if we go 8,000 under as we are at the moment in recruitment, does it really make any difference?
Well, in the case of the Army, I don't think so. If we look at the headline requirement, which the military call large scale, to generate a large capable Army division, a comprehensive expeditionary air group and a couple of maritime task groups, that can be done, partly because the Army, the 82,000 target, has a 30,000 strong Army reserve. So where there are gaps because of undermanning, the Army can pull people out of the Army Reserve. For example, mechanical and electrical engineers. The Army doesn't have all it needs, but it's got several battalions of these people sitting in the reserve. The Royal Navy and the Royal Air Force have manning challenges like the Army, but they have much smaller reserves. So in terms of being able to go to the reserve in time of emergency, the pot's going to be much, much smaller. So their overall resilience against particularly unexpected scenarios is less.
Is it just possible that actually the Army is not that bothered then about having an under-recruitment problem because it just saves a bit of money and can spend it on other things whilst turning around saying, we've got a recruitment problem?
OK, there's no doubt that for all three services, being under strength does save money. But if you go to the frontline outfits, the ships, the Air Force squadrons and the battalions and regiments, there's no doubt that not having the required number of people is unsatisfactory, particularly in peacetime where you can't train with the full deck of cards and also where a whole load of routine and administrative tasks come round more often if you've got less people. What you've also got to remember, David, is that within all three armed forces, there are generalists, but there's also a lot of specialists. I've mentioned engineers, there's logisticians, there's administrators, and particularly an ever-increasing requirement for intelligence experts. Now, each of those needs a career structure. And if, for example, you say needed 50 intelligence warrant officers, but you could only actually promote 40 because you only had 40 good enough, that's going to create an operational gap. So to feed the pyramid, you do need the minimum number of people coming in.
OK, I hadn't thought of that at all, and that's an interesting and kind of unexpected consequence. Now, we asked the Ministry of Defence for a statement about the programme, and the one they gave was that they have enough personnel to meet all our operational requirements. Is that right, do you think?
Right now, just. Where the risk would be is if it's invited to do something that's outside the Defence Ministry's planning assumptions. If, for example, it had to do what they call a medium-scale enduring operation, a challenging one with a degree of combat, the manning gaps would really, I think, come to bite on all three services.
Now, looking at the not-so-distant past, Britain provided a big part of the UN long-term operation in Bosnia. I mean, could we still do that?
With regard to something like Bosnia, yes, it could be done. But if it endured, I think what you'd see is considerable pressure on these specialists who are in short supply, like intelligence analysts, like signalers, like logisticians, like engineers. And it could be more difficult to sustain.
Now, another pressure upon us is to meet increased commitments as a result of US pressure. The United States has effectively said to all its allies, we want a greater contribution from you. Is that a factor in military planning?
Yes. Throughout my career, and I'm certain thereafter, there have been four things that the US military and the Pentagon really value. One is the British nuclear deterrent. Another is the Five Eyes intelligence relationship, US, UK, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, which is a collaborative global intelligence operation. Another one is rapidly deployable, very high-quality special forces that can instantly operate with US special forces. And the final thing is deployable conventional forces. And those are the things that are going to be in the minds of General Mattis, the US Defence Secretary, when he talks to Gavin Williamson. Well, there's no doubt the UK can produce all of those, but what it doesn't want to be is feeling strain, particularly in a long scenario, where they'd have to then say up to the US, well, this thing you asked us to do, it's much more difficult because we haven't got enough people.
Ben Barry there and Mandy Hickson. So, yes, it's a genuine problem, but what can we now do to address the recruitment gap? Anthony King, can we now look at what we would do about any of this? We've heard about the significant implications of this for operations and our capacity. Let's imagine that you now have the job of advising the government on concrete things to do to improve recruitment and retention, so that at the very least we can have our armed forces up at their target level. Now, where would we start?
For me, one of the central problems of the recruitment crisis is the very tiny size of the armed forces. So I think that actually I would recommend increasing the size of the armed forces as a way, paradoxically, of improving the recruitment situation. And I would recommend the armies expanded over the next 10 years to 100,000, the Navy and the Air Force to 40,000 each. And indeed, that is the kind of size where I think it is, has an organisation of sufficient density that it might be able to reconnect with British society.
Now, imagine I'm the Defence Secretary and I say to you, well, Anthony King, that's all very well, but I can't actually afford to do that. So tell me what I can do in order, under current budgetary requirements, to get recruiting up and to retain people.
Well, here at the level of the real and the practical, I'd say this. One of the problems, as we've discussed, is the diminishing relationship and status and legitimacy of the armed forces in British public society. So I think that is an issue which can be addressed and can be addressed at a low budgetary way. Now, there's a number of ways of doing that, but what we need to do is to move from a situation of sympathy and pity for the armed forces and understanding and empathy for the armed forces. Now, Mike Martin mentioned the adverts, the recruiting adverts, this emphasis on belonging. I'm more sceptical about these. I mean, it's very notable. There's two things that are very notable that's absent from these adverts, and they're these. One, the mission of the armed forces is the defence and security of this country. And secondly, these are highly professional organisations in which skilled soldiers, airmen and naval personnel are operating highly sophisticated operations and weaponry. And I personally would try to emphasise to the British public the mission of the armed forces and the skill and professionalism which they bring to bear on those, and that joining the armed forces is a professional vocation and dedication to the defence and security of this country. And for me, exactly this emphasis on the demotic, on the non-elite, actually is a danger for the army. Of course the army wants to be exclusive, but I would argue that professionalism, genuine skill and expertise, is an inclusive category. You're not interested in where people come from, you're interested in what people can do. And in this case, you're interested in people providing an absolutely vital service for this country. And I think sometimes British public, the government, the MOD and the army and the Air Force and the Navy have sometimes forgotten that is what their mission is. And for some young people, it's a very inspiring vocation.
Anthony King. So, to sum up, the shortage of armed forces personnel isn't critical yet, but it could get there if any big new commitment arose. And the answer isn't just about more money, it's just as much about selling a positive idea of the armed forces to wider society. Well, my thanks to Mike Martin, Anthony King, Ben Barry and Mandy Hickson. We'll be back in July. Until then, goodbye. The Briefing Room was presented by me, David Aronovich, and produced by Tim Mansell, Serena Tarling and Emma Bishop. And please let us know what you think about this programme, or indeed the entire series. You can do that by writing a review or rating us on iTunes or your podcast provider. We really love hearing from you.